Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, frustration in the Ohio House of Representatives over a proposed congressional redistricting map made the headlines. Democrat Bob Hagan expressed the tension that's been brewing between Republicans and Democrats for some time.
We've introduced legislation that brings us down here that does nothing to put people to work, to bring people out of poverty, to take care of health care. Don't interrupt me. This is about the Constitution and my ability and right to speak. So don't you dare interrupt me.
The Speaker of the Ohio House, Republican Bill Batchelder, says that strong emotions aren't anything new, especially during a time when a party's future power is being put on the line.
I've been here a long time, and I've seen a lot of these periods of time go past, and I would have to say that it's not easy for anybody out here. I understand that.
The outcome of the special House session last week sent both parties back to the drawing board, a deadline approaching all the sooner to help understand what the next steps and repercussions are will be. Columbus Dispatch reporter Jim Siegel. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thanks, Ann. Good to be here.
So just in a nutshell, is our strong emotions like that anything new these days, at least?
Well, it just a lot of it just depends on the issue. Mm-hmm. But especially in the House this session, there have been a number of very spirited and prolonged debates over a variety of issues, election reforms and the budget and other things that certainly have speaks to the just the heavy partisanship we're seeing that extends not only from Congress but also here at the State House as well. There's just a lot of divide. A lot of people are digging in heels and it's getting tougher and tougher, I think, to work across the party lines.
One of the things that Bill Batchelder said, at least that I saw in, I think it was your article in the Dispatch last week, with big picture of Bill Batchelder on the front page, characterized the latest version, the one that didn't make it, as far superior to its predecessor.
Yes.
So if it's far superior, why didn't they do it in the first place?
Well, that's a good question. They drew a map in the first place. Now, the way this goes is if the legislature draws the congressional map, so Republicans control the House and the Senate and the governor's office, so there's no Democrat in there to check or to say, wait, you have to stop this and draw it a little more competitively. I can't exactly speak to exactly why this was not done this way to begin with. I think U.S. House Speaker Boehner had a lot of input into the map that they passed back in September. Mm-hmm. And so I think they saw that map. They knew they had the vote, so they went ahead with it. It wasn't until the Democrats started threatening to referendum that map, take it to the ballot in 2012, that they took another look and decided they could make some, in what they thought were some, improvements.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jim Siegel, State House reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. We're talking about the redistricting issue at the State House right now. Jim, if the Republicans had garnered enough votes at Thursday's session, their redistricting map could have, the new one, could have been passed as an emergency legislation. Now what's going to happen?
Well, now it goes, because there was a procedural vote taken, which would have basically allowed the map to come up for a vote without having to go through the normal committee process. That also needs a two-thirds vote, as does an emergency clause. Well, they didn't get two-thirds. They got 58 votes. They need 66. So what happens is essentially the bill now goes back into committee. The speaker said he's going to put it in the rules committee, which all that means is there's a committee with the number of the leadership on both sides of the aisle are on the rules committee. And so by putting it there, and even the speaker even mentioned this, that could give them an opportunity to talk more rather than putting it in some other committee where the leaders aren't sitting at the table next to each other. He hopes to start hearings this week on the map, and they're still working it out because the congressional primary was moved to June. They still think they have some time to maybe try to get a deal done so that we don't have this great uncertainty heading into 2012, where essentially we just don't have a map in place, and now you have the courts involved, and we're trying to figure out what to do.
Democrat Armin Budish said a plan proposed by Democrats was more reasonable. Let's listen.
The proposal that we made would have created 6 Republican districts, 4 Democrat districts, and 6 competitive districts, although the 6 competitive districts would all lean Republican.
So Speaker Batchelder said the Democrats' plan was turned in just the night before the Republicans introduced their map, which was too late for consideration by the Ohio House. What about that Democratic proposal? Was it spitting in the wind in the first place, or was that something that's doable?
Well, it's hard. I can't speak to it too much because they have not actually released the actual map. They've put out the numbers on this is what the political indexes are in all of our new districts that we propose, but they haven't actually put out the map where you can see where the actual lines are drawn. So it's hard to, you know, to make a true, you know, comparison as to what this map looks like compared to others, because, you know, when you're talking about these districts, it's not just about what county is in which district, but it's also about which incumbents are drawn together. As you know, we're going from 18 congressional districts down to 16, so it means two of the folks who are in there now are going to be gone no matter what happens. We're losing two. Under the Republican map, it would be a Republican and a Democrat who would both lose out. I don't know what the Democratic map does in terms of drawing folks together, and so it's hard to say politically whether it would be feasible or not. Even though, like Leader Buttigieg said, that he thinks that it's a more competitive map and more fair.
The Republicans who stand to potentially lose, stand to face a primary in one of the new districts, seem to be in polite abeyance right now. Are they working behind the scenes on their own behalf, or are they just sitting back and waiting?
Oh, no, they're always working behind the scenes. There's no doubt about that. The 2-year cycle leading up to a congressional map drawing, you see a lot of campaign contributions go from the congressional campaigns into the House and Senate caucus campaigns and the state level. There's a reason for that. They're very involved, and I'm sure. Still trying to work this out, you know. Like I said, in the Dayton area, you've got Representatives Turner and Austria. Two Republicans have been drawn together up in northern Cleveland, Toledo area. They managed to stretch a district all the way along Lake Erie to capture.
I call it the beachfront district.
It is a beachfront district. If we get a lot of rain, a lot of it might get wiped out, you know, because it's really that close to the lake. But it puts Dennis Kucinich and Marcy Kaptur together. So. Yes, there are a lot of backroom deals. Dennis Kucinich in particular has been very vocal and also was sending stuff to his supporters and telling them to, you know, to argue against what the Republicans are trying to do.
Last week, the League of Women Voters, Peg Rosenfield, made a point that callers from a previous All Sides show have made in regards to redistricting.
This just demonstrates that we need to use a completely different process for drawing district lines. This process is broken.
So will it take a political crisis, or is it at that crisis point for structural change to actually take place, or at least not this time around?
You know, at normal times, I'd say yes, maybe we are at that point. But the way things have gone, you know, politically, it's hard to say if there's ever going to be a crisis point that spurs particular action because of just how divided everybody is these days. But I will say that there are definitely Republicans in both the House and the Senate chambers working with Secretary of State John Houston and trying to get something crafted. I know there's been renewed interest from the Democrats, particularly in the House, on trying to get something done. I'm not sure how close they are to a deal because, you know, as you're aware, you know, you can say I don't like the current system, but there's 100 ways you could do this that would be alternatives. And the problem is that, you know, you've got Democrats who say, well, we've got to make sure that competitiveness gets in there as one of the main factors for drawing districts. And then Republicans say, no, we need compactness in there as the main factor. And so just little things, they sound like little things, but those can have huge impacts on what the final maps look like. And so they continue to be heavily debated.
Well, regardless whether you're on the competitiveness side or the compactness side, the whole idea of getting control of all those statewide elected offices, at least in that last year, was to take control of the board and take control of the process.
Absolutely.
And so if it's slanted toward the Republicans, isn't that their due? Some people think it is.
Absolutely. And that's the way it's been in the past. I mean, the Republicans, when they control things, they draw the thing, you know, maps the way they like it. And same when the Democrats have been in control in past decades as well. So that's why, you know, the Speaker has said, you know, there's some members of his caucus who question why they're doing this at all when, you know, look, we won. This is what we get to do when we win. We get to draw the map. And unless you can get a court to tell us that we've stepped over some Voting Rights Act line or or something like that, then this is the map you have to deal with. But this is the first time, you know, Democrats have stepped up and said, no, we're gonna use our referendum rights. Now we've seen how well we can do with Senate Bill 5 and the elections bill, which is also being, will probably also be on the referendum ballot in 2012. They've decided this is now their tool to use and to try to beat back legislation they think Republicans have gone too far.
But with Senate Bill 5 and issue 2, there are really easily identifiable constituencies to get the referendum, or get the collect signatures across the state willing to volunteer. With something like redistricting, do people care that much? Rank and file people across the country, across the state, do they really care? Do they get it? Would it be as easy as Senate Bill 5?
Oh, it would absolutely not be as easy as Senate Bill 5. You're absolutely right. There are 360,000 public union members out there that are directly impacted by Senate Bill 5. Most people you talk to couldn't tell you which number district they're in congressional district, and it's just not something you think about, and not that you really should. I mean, going through your daily life, you wonder if you're in the 12th or the 15th district. But they would have to play on the issues of fairness. That this is a power grab by the Republicans is how they would try to describe it. Republicans would argue, no, this is fair the way we've done it. They each put out their own political indexes to try to argue their map is fair. But it would be it would be more of a debate in the clouds than it would be a direct impact.
The whole, I don't know if irony is the right word, but when this becomes important and people start talking about the process or at times like this where it doesn't matter, you can't change the process now, Secretary of State John Husted tried to change the process, and he may try again, but when you have time and to have the thoughtful conversations, nobody really cares.
Right. Well, that's one of the points he made last year when he was trying to do this, is that he was just having a hard time getting people to focus on it. It's just not, a lot. There's a lot of longtime establishment members of both parties who just say, we kind of like the way things are now. We like to have the control. They don't want to lose the power of the pen. And so regardless of whether they may get, hosed on it every other election. It's a tough thing to get folks to stick to, and I imagine it'll still be tough even this year.
Is there another state out there that lost seats that's having the same kind of problems Ohio is?
Not necessarily all for the same reason. Mm-hmm. There's other states I'm trying to remember which ones. There's at least one or two states that where the legislature just broke and didn't pass any map. And they couldn't come, they're split legislatures and they just couldn't come to an agreement. So they just went home and didn't pass a map. And now it's going to be just completely left up to the courts. We're not alone in this. This is certainly not something that happens in a lot of states, but it's, we're not by ourselves.
And what court would it wind up in?
I've been told it could go to state, it could go to federal, because it's our congressional race,
right.
And they also have implications on the presidential race, because presidential candidates have to gather signatures inside these congressional districts in order to get on the ballot.
A certain number of signatures from each district.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. That leads you to believe it would be a federal court that would decide this. And I couldn't fathom which one exactly it would start in and how the process would go necessarily, but some have also said it's possible it could also go to the state level, but I would guess at this point it would go to the federal court.
Okay. Jim, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Yep, no problem.
Jim Siegel, he's State House reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Coming up, we're going to hear about a documentary about stopping the violence in our streets. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, time's almost up for the bipartisan deficit-reducing Congressional Super Committee. We'll look at what's coming from behind the closed doors. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins this afternoon at 1 o'clock on 89.7 NPR News. Women, War, and Peace, War Redefined challenges the conventional wisdom that war and peace are men's domain. Tuesday night on WOSU-TV, watch interviews with leading thinkers, secretaries of state, and seasoned survivors of war and peacemaking. Their experiences reveal how women are emerging as necessary partners in brokering lasting peace and as leaders in forging new international laws governing conflict. Watch Women, War, and Peace, War Redefined, Tuesday night at 9 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from Columbus College of Art and Design, offering continuing education courses to update your creative career skills. Information and online registration are available now at www.ccad.edu.
57 degrees in downtown Columbus. Partly sunny skies today, warming up to a high of 64. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 46 degrees. More sunshine tomorrow, a high of 68. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Some young Americans in our cities live in a kind of war zone. Homicide has been the leading cause of death for African-American youth between the ages of 15 and 24 for more than three decades in the United States. In 2008, approximately 670,000 young people between the ages of 10 and 24 were treated in emergency rooms for injuries sustained due to violence. Today on All Sides, we're talking about an innovative approach to violence prevention among at-risk young people. A new documentary film, The Interrupters, tells the story of violence interrupters in Chicago who intervene in conflicts before they explode into violence. The film will be screened on Wednesday at the Wexner Center's Mershon Auditorium. For more information, go to wexarts.org or call 614-292-3535. You can also go to our website at wosu.org/allsides if you remember that and forget everything else. Joining us now is Zach Piper. He's the director of production for Cartam Quinn Films and the co-producer of The Interrupters, which will air as part of the PBS Frontline series in 2012. Welcome, Zach.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Also joining us from Chicago is Amina Matthews. Whose work as one of the violence interrupters is a prominent subject in the documentary. Amina works for Ceasefire. It's an initiative of the Chicago Project for Violence Prevention. Welcome, Amina.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Zach, tell us about the genesis of the documentary film. Steve James, well, tell us why a documentary on this topic now.
Well, I mean, Alex Kotlowitz had been working with Ceasefire for a year, working on a piece for the Times magazine. And after that was published, Steve and Alex got together and decided that this might be a great idea for a film. And I've worked with Steve before in the past in other films, so the three of us sort of went out and, it seemed like a very timely subject here in Chicago where, every day, every few days, you open the paper in the morning and you see that there's been, a dozen shootings overnight. It's a huge issue here in Chicago, as in other cities.
Let's listen to a scene from the documentary during a prayer vigil for a young man shot and killed on the streets of Chicago. Amina Matthews confronts a group of young black men. She asks them very strongly to look out for the children and lead by example.
Who does this little shorty belong to? He just hanging around, y'all? He just he just hanging around, y'all, right? So he see everything that you all do, right? So if this brother right here catch a case and do 100 years, whose fault is it? It's his fault?
Amina, the thing about that part of the movie was I couldn't take my eyes off the face of the child. I should say the younger child, the one, who you were asking about.
Yeah, the little shorty.
He kind of was looking around like, wow, someone's supposed to be taking care of me?
Right. Somebody claim me, right?
Now.
Yeah. He was kind of afraid at the time of, but what we didn't show on the film is I asked a question about someone that's in jail. My father, and how much jail time, how much time is he locked up? And he was the only, this is a 9-year-old, and at the time I had a 9-year-old, she's 10 now, and he answered to the hour and the second that my dad is in lockup. And I'm like, you know what? This little kid is 9 years old. He's around these little young guys all the time, obviously. So he knows what's going on because he listens to you guys.
You, there were a lot of segments with children in the movie, but a lot of it revolved around what the work you do, the work your colleagues do, Amina. You got your chops the old-fashioned way. You lived the life.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
First of all, I do have to say I was raised by my grandmother, and she did the best that she could with what she had to work with. She was a single mother, and then she had to be a single young grandmother. And she didn't, you know, throw me away and tell my mother, look, you had this baby, you take care of it at the age of 16. So she worked from dark 30 to dark 30 to make sure that we were fine. But I noticed that we were poor. You know, I noticed when I look around to my other friends and their families where their fathers was in the household, and, you know, they had two televisions and it was colored, opposed to we had one with two stations and it was black and white. So as I looked around and I saw my surroundings of, you know, guys and girls out on the street, big money, cars, you know, I said, man, I want that type of life to help my grandmother get up out of the hood. And that's exactly what I was attracted to, and that's the life that I lived from the age of 16 to early 20s, mid-20s, until I got shot.
And how did you turn your life around? How did you become a violence interrupter for Ceasefire?
Oh, wow. That's another show in itself.
I bet it is. There's just a lot going on.
It is. One of the guys that I was out there hustling that showed me the game back in the day, his name is James Highsmith, and he went to jail. That's how our organization dismantled, because he went to jail and did some federal time. So when he got out, he was introduced to Ceasefire through a friend. T.O. Hardiman, which is the director over mediation, hired him, and I moved back to Chicago, and it was a very volatile situation that was going to go down at one of the high schools, at Leo High School, which is an all-boys school, and it's right in the middle of an area in Chicago called Auburn Gresham. It's highly trafficked, very busy, and a mother called T.O. and said, my son is going to kill somebody, or he's going to be killed today. I need some help. And T.O. called Highsmith, and Highsmith said, hey, Amina, can you help me? I need your help. And I told my husband that I wanted to help, and I got in the car, and I went to this area, and I found this little young guy. And it took me maybe about 45 minutes to convince this guy that, for one, I wasn't the police, and for two, I wasn't trying to kill him. Let's talk about it, what's going on. And he pulled my file. He found out that I was Amina, and he got in my van, and we talked about it, as well as James was talking to the other side and got the other side to put their guns down, and he promised that he was going to put his gun down, and now this young guy is down south in Atlanta. He's in his third year in college, and he's doing quite well, and his mother's very happy.
We are talking about a new documentary film, The Interrupters. It tells the story of violence interrupters in Chicago who intervene in conflicts before they explode into violence. If you're just joining us, my guests are Amina.
That's me.
Yep. And Zach is the filmmaker. If you have any questions or comments for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Zach, how did you decide to focus on Amina and the others, T.O., and then there was a third interrupter?
Yes, Kobe and Eddie. I mean, I think for us, we were going to these weekly meetings that they have at UIC, at University of Illinois Chicago, which is where the Ceasefire offices are. And we would go down there in these weekly meetings, and it was pretty clear right away that Amina was someone that we were all interested in, and anyone who's seen the film will understand why. I mean, she's very, you know, charismatic, has a really powerful presence. And there were other people around the table that we were interested in, but it really sort of came down to what where would we have access? Who were we comfortable with? Who was comfortable with us? And that sort of is how, in some ways, the decisions were made for us. I mean, it was just sort of like what was the most natural fit. And we wanted to, you know, we did want to try to get different parts of the city and not just focus in on one particular neighborhood. So Eddie, for instance, brings us to a different part of the city, the west side of Chicago. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to get them, you know, we're seeing this work taking place in different communities.
Amina Matthews, what was your sense about in the production of it, in the filming documentary, the impact it might have had on the situations you were in? Because we're such a media-conscious society now, having a camera pointed at you, did it change the dynamics, in your opinion?
Well, you know, that was a perception that I kind of had before allowing them into my world. As Zach can tell you, it took me a minute to be, Alex would say, it was a long courtship before I committed to actually giving them something that is what I do in the streets, as far as mediating on the front end. And by me doing a lot of media before then, it was kind of, you know, are they going to do us right? Are they going to make it into some sense and sensible of what we go through on a secondly basis in our communities? And I was reluctant on the onset before I even committed to it. But as they started stalking me, it was really...
What are you
going to
do?
Yeah, the courtship turned into stalking. Trust that. You know, they were really on a serious note. They were very so gentle and so empathetic and understanding to what was going on. And 10 times out of 10, the circumstances and the situations that I was dealing with, it was so intense that I forgot that they were there, because it wasn't that they were hanging over my back or I was feeling them breathing over my neck or the camera was in my face. It was nothing like that. And sometimes after we filmed a little bit, you know, I said, well, I hope this is done in a way that it's neat. It's clear on what was going on and what is needed. And once I started seeing, maybe one time I saw it because I needed to do voiceover, and I saw bits and clips of it, and they put it together so to the truth of what's going on in our community that I'm really so grateful. And people that I talked to before I did the documentary, after seeing it, they're very, very appreciative to Steve, Alex, and Zach, because the conversation has to become action now, and the documentary is really the platform to bring action. So I'm really grateful for that.
At the top of the hour, we played a cut, Amina, of you when you were speaking at that funeral. In another scene from the documentary, we hear from the funeral home director, Spencer Leake. During the civil rights era, he was a chauffeur for the Reverend Martin Luther King. Now he sees the result of street violence on a daily basis, he says.
How can the president of the United States be a black man? I never thought I'd see that in my lifetime. But while I'm seeing the president on television and the images of him leading the free world, I'm still burying black kids. It just doesn't make sense to me.
Mr. Leake had a shocking statistic about the percentage of funerals that he manages, the percentage of young people that make up that number. You can just hear the devastation in his voice, though.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't a cut and dry story. This isn't one of those happy endings necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
Zach, how did you frame that? How did you feel about framing it that way?
I mean, you know, part of the process for us was, I mean, practically speaking, was we wanted to find stories that we could track over a long period of time. So we weren't just, you know, swooping in, getting a few shots or getting a snippet of a story and then running with it. We were sort of tracking it over time, and that's those are the stories we really we included in the film. And the idea was to sort of give a more complex picture of what is happening, you know, in people's lives and in the neighborhoods. And I mean, despite, you know, the grim nature of the topic, I mean, there's plenty of, you know, hope, and there's plenty of positive things that we filmed and that we included in the film.
Mm-hmm. Amina, how do you know? Well, first of all, Dr. Gary Slutkin, he's the epidemiologist and the founder of Ceasefire. Mm-hmm. He characterizes the violence as a disease. Mm-hmm. And he says that it's a myth that most of the violence is gang related. Can you talk about that, Amina? And it didn't seem to be gang related from what we saw in the documentary.
Well, it's historically known, as far as in the streets or on the structure of the gangs, that they're not there anymore. So what we see now and what's going on now is that these young guys and girls that may live in a historical gang territory, they might adapt whatever star of that particular nation or what their family member from back in the day may have inherited. They may feel that they have to inherit it as well. But what we're seeing now and what I'm seeing now, because, you know, being there and done that and now seeing what's going on now, is these guys and girls are, they're not leading by example, nor are they following by the examples that was set from the organization back in the day as far as the membership. They're just really clicking. They're, you know, if there's a family and they have friends that's from another set, and if there's a beef going on, they may rally together, and it's two different, you know, organizations, if you will. They'll maybe fighting together on one beef with someone. So it's not typically the gang action that is going on today like it was back in the day. It's not that anymore. It's just a lot of misinformed information that these young guys and girls are getting and that they have adapted, and the structure is not there as far as the membership that they're not upholding. They don't even know anything about the membership of any of the gangs anymore. So it's a bunch of cliques. It's a bunch of young guys and girls dealing off of emotions and dealing off of maybe a mind mood altering substance in their ego. So that's really what's going on now.
It's noted in the film that you get in where a lot of the guys can't get in. And I was wondering how you know when a situation suits your skills and when it's safe, or do you not know? How do you make those judgments?
Wow. I don't know. I just, you know, it's really a gut, heart, and soul decision that I make. I don't feel that anyone should have to, you know, I was out there part of the problem, man. I was out there and I did, but there were things that is going on today in life society that I wouldn't dare, or the guys that I hung out with, we wouldn't dare, or my father wouldn't dare dream to do today. So when it's time to get down in the trenches and make sure that I can educate in the process of them putting down their guns, I don't think anybody should, I don't think anybody deserves to die in the midst of resolving a conflict or communicating. So it's really a combination of my heart and that gut. And, you know, I pull back when there's, you know, when I feel that it's needed to. Mm-hmm. I really can't pinpoint. I really strongly believe that this is a purpose of mine. We do have training on the ethics and the professionalism. And as you've seen in the documentary, some of that stuff wasn't brought out.
I don't know. Far be it from me to judge.
But, it, you know, it's really, I really strongly believe that I'm on my purpose. And it's the combination between, you know, that intuition of how things feel from, you know, form of reference back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always, you know, you can, when you're out there, you can sense when something's not right, when, you know, when it's all good, when it's not good, when you know, mm-hmm. danger ahead, you can sense that. And I still have that intuition today, and it's a lot keener now that I'm a mother and, you know, and just love doing what I do.
Amina, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Amina Matthews, she's a senior violence interrupter for Ceasefire. It's an initiative of the Chicago Project for Violence Prevention. And Zach, thanks as well to you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Zach Piper is the director of production for Cartim Quinn Films and the co-producer of The Interrupters. The Interrupters, the documentary will be screened on Wednesday at the Wexner Center's Mershon Auditorium. For more information, go to wexarts.org. or call 614-292-3535. Coming up, we're going to hear from the founders of a similar movement in Columbus. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
In 14 years on Saturday Night Live, Daryl Hammond did many impressions, including Bill Clinton.
I rehearsed it with a southern accent, and then I put in this little crackle in my voice.
Few of the cast members knew Hammond struggled with drink, drugs, and self-cutting as a result of childhood abuse. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Daryl Hammond. He has a new memoir.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Join us tomorrow for All Sides with Ann Fisher at 11 o'clock for Tech Tuesday, a discussion of social media and the election, and also upgrading your computer. Join us for Tech Tuesday on All Sides, tomorrow at 11. 57 degrees in downtown Columbus, partly sunny skies today, warming up to a high of 64. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 46. More sunshine on Tuesday, and a high of 68. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We are talking about an innovative approach to violence prevention among at-risk young people. A new documentary film, The Interrupters, tells the story of violence interrupters in Chicago who try to intervene before there's violence. Joining us now are the founder and co-chair of the OSU Youth Violence Prevention Advisory Board. They've started a similar ceasefire program in Central Ohio. Dr. Deanna Wilkinson is a criminologist and expert on urban youth violence and violence prevention. She is currently an associate professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Science at OSU. She is the director of the Columbus Violence Prevention Collaborative. Welcome back, Deanna.
Hi, Ann. Thank you.
Tammy Fournier is an outreach specialist at Ohio State University. She also serves on the Franklin Pre-Release Citizens Advisory Board and the Franklin County Reentry Task Force, where she chairs the subcommittee Faith, Family, and Community. Welcome to the show, Tammy.
Thank you for having me, Ann.
Deanna, there's going to be two screenings of The Interrupters at the Wexner Center on Wednesday, one for high school students and one at Mershon Auditorium for the general public. Why two different screenings?
Well, the Wexner staff approached the Columbus City Schools for an additional opportunity to screen with the young people, and Dr. Harris was really keen to see this happen, and we've partnered to make it be a community school initiative where the young people will see the film and then really be able to take this as a leadership opportunity to talk about how they could get involved in the public education campaign component of a violence prevention initiative, not specifically ceasefire, but more broadly. And so that's the daytime screening, which is a closed special screening for 20 high school students from each of the high schools in the city and two of the alternative schools. And then the evening screening, of course, is for the general public. And, you know, the Mershon Auditorium holds a lot of people. We're really hoping that that will attract a large crowd.
And there's going to be a conversation afterwards.
Yes.
with the filmmaker and...
And Amina Matthews will be here, and Eddie will be here as well, and also a surprise guest, which people don't know about yet because it's not advertised. Dr. Sletkin will be here to share with us on the panel as well. So
The film, when you obviously you've seen it, how does it resonate? How do the themes in that resonate for you in terms of Central Ohio? I guess, Tammy, you've seen the film.
Yes, I've seen the film. Actually, I was honored to be a part of a team of us who traveled to Chicago to meet with some of the sites around the country for a cluster meeting. And so we got opportunity to see it in Chicago, also to be what we call boots on the ground in Chicago, go out to one of the sites. So I've seen it here with a group of counselors here in Columbus again. So I've seen it probably 5 times now. I think each time that I see it, something else resonates with me. If you're talking about, and we're talking about Chicago, and this film is focused on what's going on in Chicago, but these same things are going on right here in Columbus, Ohio, right here in our community. The thing that resonates with me most is, and I'm just grateful that you played the clip from the funeral director, is that it's a shame. You know, it's often unbelievable. My work as outreach specialist for the Columbus Violence Prevention Collaborative and Columbus Ceasefire is going out on the streets, similar to kind of what you see Amina doing in the film. But really going out, we've really been working around mobilizing the community and the public education pieces over the last year and a half. And so part of that outreach is going to some of these funerals. And what's most overwhelming and seeing it in the film each time, those feelings come back that I feel sitting in these funeral homes and watching hundreds and sometimes, you know, 200-300 young people from our city, from our neighborhoods in this community that have begun to identify who they are with these funerals, with this grief, with this mourning, looking in the face of young men and knowing that they don't expect to make it.
It should be a rare occurrence in a young person's life that they attend a funeral. It should be family. It shouldn't be friend after friend, acquaintance after acquaintance.
It's not normal, and it's so abnormal to me. This past summer, we probably went to a funeral a week, sometimes two in a week. 16, 17-year-old young men with their lives and their futures in front of them, you would think, that they have every right to expect to grow up and to live out whatever their desires are. But we're burying these young people. And so that part of it is what sticks with me. It causes me to do this work. I know I can speak for Deanna. It's what drives us. We've got to get this message out there. I'm just so excited that this film is here, that we're 2 days away from an opportunity to really have a conversation. I tell people a lot that it's not about our titles and our positions. It's about our community. It's about how can we sit down and begin to give these young people some hope other than expecting. I used to see them expect to go to prison, young people out of these communities. They expected to do something and get sent off to.
And indeed, a very high percentage of them
do go to prison, and they expect to. But now they're expecting to die. They don't even talk about prison to that degree. They're literally talking about dying. And in every conversation, we were just with probably 50 or 60 people out of the community yesterday with a monthly march. And you hear it again and again. They're expecting that something is going to happen, that they're not going to make it.
How do you, Deanna Wilkinson and Tammy, I mean, how do you move forward with these kinds of efforts in an economy like this where truly there is a very slim chance that they're going to get jobs, which we know can help keep kids in line and keep them busy and keep them off the street? How do you keep all of it together knowing that this protracted recession or recovery from recession is doing them the most harm of anybody in society?
Well, it's a difficult time, but that issue is separate from the issue of taking up a gun and being unsafe in your community. And so, you know, the first step in some ways is a very basic step of making their lives safe and undoing this phenomenon that has become a norm in certain communities and, you know, certain blocks and certain cities.
It looked like in the film, a lot of times when Amina or Teal Hardiman or Eddie were talking to people and actually interrupting potential violence, that it's the first time anyone had had that conversation with them. Have you found that,
yes.
Tammy?
Yes, for sure. There's a scene in the film where Amina speaks about wanting someone to come for her. And that part touches me. I think I cry at that part. I'm just going to share that now because I'll probably cry on Wednesday night at that part. But that's that feeling that you have when you grow up. And I come from that lifestyle. I come from a generational family of that lifestyle. And so coming out of that lifestyle, one, my story was a little different from Amina's. It wasn't about trying to have something better. I was born into a lifestyle where it was the cars and the illegal activity from the time I came into the world. And so it was my normal. But coming out of that lifestyle and once you realize that what you're doing is something that's going to lead to your destruction, you want a way out. You're waiting for someone to come and bring you the answer. And so I see it again and again really young people where they're looking for someone to provide, I call, a way of escape, either in the heat of conflict, either in their community. They're looking for that one resource. Typically what I see is the bridge of disconnect. It's just that one step. And Columbus is blessed to be a city of a lot of resources. There's a lot of people in communities. We've done a lot of work around mapping what's in this target neighborhood that we're looking to begin this work in. And so we have a lot of community partners. Over 100 are part of our Youth Violence Advisory Board. And so the foundation is really laid. Where we are right now, we're at a unique point, and I'm again hopeful that this film will help spark some of that conversation, is connecting those pieces. You talked about the economy, and yeah, things are tight. Things are tough all over in every community.
The worst in our generation.
Yes, for sure. And so I think that alone should cause us to begin to reevaluate what's important. It's important that our young people have every opportunity to be safe. This is about the adults now. The adults have a responsibility to the next generation of young people, that we begin to stop looking at them as them on the corner or those young people. But these are our children. These are all of our young people. We've got to get engaged. And it's real simple. You see it in the film again and again. It's just having that conversation. Coming out, open up your window and open your front door, sitting on your porch and engaging with our young people.
You know, a lot of the people that you have to turn to in the neighborhoods are older teenagers. They are the role models. Mm-hmm. Everybody else is gone.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Deanna, how much? Let's see if Tony on the East Side, welcome to the show. You wanted to talk about education?
Yeah, I just had a question. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know what role education or the lack of education might have on this problem of violence.
Are you talking about classroom in the schools education?
Well, I think in general. I mean, I think there's a way that we pass on information to our young people generationally, but also there's a very specific institutionalized way we educate young people to go on to fulfill their potential. And when they don't have that, if they drop out of school or if they, you know, they're not successful in school, what impact does that have on, what correlation does that have with this move toward violence and violent activity?
Deanna?
Well, one of the things that is very stark about high-risk individuals who are at the greatest risk of being shot or being a shooter is that they're disenfranchised from just about every institution, from the church, from the community, from the elders in the community, from school. And so in the process of helping them to change their lives, to change their behavior, education is certainly one of the major strategies that we use to, you know, try to attract them back into mainstream, because they're so isolated away from both the resources and even seeing an opportunity. Opportunities are out there for someone else. You know, they could live on the same block as other kids who've made it out of the hood and done really well, but they just don't see it for them because their world is so clouded with all of the negative that just keeps spiraling generation after generation. So yes, education is key. But again, the process of really helping to launch a behavioral change through this intervention takes time and takes effort, and really it's an 18-month process. And that's something you don't see specifically in the film, but it doesn't happen overnight for any of us, any people.
Thanks a lot, Tony. It's one person at a time, It takes a long time. And Tammy Fournier, you mentioned that you literally grew up in it from birth. It was the violence, the lifestyle was part of yours. So how young do you go when we talk about education? How young do you start to reach out to children about?
I've learned through education and educating myself that it starts at birth. I didn't know that growing up. But I can look back now over my childhood and realize that I was being educated to a thing, and it was a lifestyle of. And let me be clear in saying that when I was growing up, we didn't have this type of violence. Young people didn't die on the streets. For someone to die, period, involved in criminal activity, as we called it, or illegal lifestyle, or we called it the life, that was rare. We didn't kill each other.
Prison, you know, as we mentioned earlier.
People went away to prison. They didn't die. And so it was very rare to see that happen. And so that's what's most alarming to me is how things have evolved into very, very petty things become issues of life and death. I grew up really, you know, idolizing the lifestyle. And I think in Dr. Wilkinson's work, one of the things that attracted me to her and I became so excited to work with her on this is that her work on identity amongst African Americans and Latino youth really resonated with me because my identity was tied to a life of, you know, my father was a pimp and my mother was a booster and that's who I was. And I had to grow up to emulate that and those mannerisms. And
because that's what you were taught.
That's what I saw and that's what I was taught. And everything else around me that was in opposition to that was abnormal for me. So I grew up really, you know, it took me going to prison. It took me doing what people out of this neighborhood did, going to prison and really kind of beginning to watch this happen and seeing people, young people especially, cycle in and out. I knew that I wanted to find out why this happens. It really was a whole mindset change. And even now, you know, in my 50 now, it's still mindset changing because working now in relationship with the justice system and police and really trying to work towards solutions. I know that a lot of young people, their identity is tied to this lifestyle. And so once we get them to see that you can still be culturally who you are, but it doesn't mean that you have to be attracted to or be a person that's caught up in this violent identity that my power and who I am is tied to who I can hurt today.
Email from Veronica. Whatever happened to the Guardian Angels of Columbus? They were the young men with the red caps. It came from New York City and had a strong presence in the Near East Side. They made a difference. What's the difference between something like what the Guardian Angels did, Deanna, and what the ceasefire paradigm is all about?
Well, I'm not really sure about the Guardian Angels because I guess I haven't been in Columbus long enough. But the ceasefire interrupters and the outreach workers really have a much broader depth in terms of the relationships that they build with the young people, and it is all about building those relationships and also with the older people in the community and really having a whole community-based approach to engaging around this issue, around reinforcing that same message over and over again that violence is not the answer and that this is not normal, it's not acceptable, it's not going to be what happens on this in this neighborhood anymore. And it's more than just being out there and being present. It's really a long-term relationship. And I don't know if that earlier initiative had those same elements, but I can say that the parts that make ceasefire work are really about relationships.
Well, Deanna Wilkinson, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate having you back. Deanna is the director of the Columbus Violence Prevention Collaborative, and also Tammy Fournier. She is a co-chair of the OSU Youth Violence Prevention Advisory Board. Tammy, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it. Just want to remind folks that the interrupters will be screened Wednesday, November 9th at 7 p.m. at the Wexner Center's Mershon Auditorium. For more information, go to wexarts.org or call 614-292-3535. And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.